a lot of action going on in the first Aliyah of Toldos. A very major part of the Yaakov and Esau story happens here, and a lot that has to say about our whole mission and history in life. So first we begin the Eila Toldos Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram Holidus Yitzchak. So first of all, what are we talking about by the name of the parsha? What does Toldos mean? So Toldos usually means the descendants, and that would fit the sentence in some sense. But the Mefarshim also discussed it could either mean descendants, or it could also mean this is the story of the life. And therefore, this is also a very significant parsha as far as telling you what happens. It's interesting, I think this parallels, we had a similar discussion at the beginning of Parshas Noach, where you find the same opening, Eila Toldos Noach, and there as well, this discussion, is that meant to identify his descendants, where it wasn't really the continuation of the story at that point, or is it telling you the story of his life? So here, there's a good case that could be made really for either, and it continues over to the next words of Yitzchak ben Avram. So are we emphasizing the ancestry here, that Yitzchak is the son of Avram, or as some of the Rishonim say, the Bali Atosis, the Barbanel, that this is to indicate that there's a parallelism between their lives, and that Yitzchak did things along the same pattern as Avram did. It's interesting whether there's a specific definition, if we're talking about descendants, to say that Toldos Yitzchak, then say Ben Avram, so that Kliyakar suggests that there is a difference. It's probably a little counterintuitive the way he says it. He would have maybe interpreted the opposite. But Kliyakar understands that Ben doesn't have to be a biological son. It could be anybody who raised someone. While Toldos, that is more about the biological history here, which again is probably the opposite of maybe how you would have interpreted it. And in fact, when the Pasuk goes on to say, Avram holid is Yitzchak, that some understand that the holid is to be a reference to the fact that he raised Yitzchak, not just that he created the reality of Yitzchak being born, so to speak, but that he raised him, and that it's to emphasize that even though the other sons he distanced himself from, the children of Hagar, but Yitzchak was his focus, and he put all his energies into raising Yitzchak. We know that the Gemara also tells us in Bava Metzia, and Daf Pei Zayin, Rashi quotes the idea that the Torah emphasizes that Avram holid is Yitzchak because the Leitzanei Hador, the scoffers of the generation, would make a claim that Avram was not really the father. And therefore, in order to make it clear that he was the father, so it happened that Yitzchak had the exact demos of Avram. Yitzchak looked exactly like Avram. So it's interesting, one of the points that emerges from that idea is we talk about Leitzanei Hador. It's a strange claim to make, because if you want to say that here Avram and Sarah were of such an advanced age, so it doesn't make sense to say that they could be the biological parents and that somebody else must have been one parent to the other, you'd think that claim would have been made more strongly about Sarah, that if Sarah is able to have a child at such an advanced age, so clearly there's something miraculous going on here. So why would they target Avram and say, well, Avram's probably not the father, it's not going to make it much less of a miracle. So this perhaps displays the idea, we talk about Leitzanei Hador. Leitzanus has a specific translation. Nowadays, we use it in modern Hebrew a little bit more loosely. We talk about somebody who is a clown, somebody who makes jokes. So we talk about Leitzanus as a lighthearted skit, perhaps, a Purimspiel. But in the classical literature, in Tanakh and in Shas, it seems that Aletz is a cynic. Aletz is somebody who doesn't take anything seriously, and that's why we have very harsh comments directed at the concept of leitzanus, and the Bali Musar say that somebody who has any leitzanus in them, all the musar in the world is not going to get through, because the whole midah of a letz is that he doesn't take anything seriously, and the things that he should respect, he has no chashivas for. So essentially what you see here is that what the letz says doesn't have to make any sense, doesn't have to be a logical objection. They're just ready to try to knock down everything. So they can't deny that Sarah was the mother. Okay, they'll deny that Avram was the father. Whatever it is that they can use to knock down a miracle, to knock down a chash of a person, they'll use it. It doesn't have to make sense. And this is something I think we see very often in real life, that this is an attribute that plays out, that a scoffer, a cynic, is ready just to attack. It doesn't have to have any rationality behind it. So the pasuk continues to tell us, "Vayitzchok ben Arba'im shana bekachto es Rivka bas Bisuel Harami mipadon Aram achos Lavan Harami lo liisha." So Yitzchok was 40 years old when he got married, and the Radak and the Ralbag emphasize that this is being told to us here because we're going to hear soon enough about the birth of his children. And we want to emphasize that that was also a miraculous process, as we'll see, because apparently it took 20 years. That they was married for 20 years before the children were born. So the Torah is emphasizing that he was 40 years when they got married, and that shows just how long they had to wait in order for the children to be born. Some of the Mefarshim talk about why it is that Yitzchak waited until he was 40 to get married, and you find some commentary here which is very familiar, was involved in the whole dating scene. So the Netziv writes that it couldn't find the right one. So it took until then to find the right person. It's a very familiar issue. And others suggest that he was deliberately waiting because he was working on himself first. This is part of the attitude of tzaddikim. They feel they have to make sure they have a certain level of shlemus, and that's what he was waiting for. So how old was Rivka? So I know this is a famous medrash, which is also very hard to relate to, because Rashi quotes the idea that we find in some places that Rivka was 3 years old. The assumption being that Yitzchak was 37 at the time of the Akedah, and the Torah tells us on the way back from the Akedah they heard of the birth of Rivka. So if he got married when he was 40, then she must have been 3, which is clearly hard for us to relate to. You have to imagine a very different level of maturity being applicable at that time if that was the case. So not everyone agrees that this is actually the fact. And Tosfos and Maseches Yevamos, for example, and a few other Rishonim, but Tosfos and Yevamos and Daf Samach Aleph Amud Beis has other rayas to come to a different conclusion, that she was 14, which certainly is still young by today's standards, but not in the same kind of unimaginably young as 3 years old would have suggested, and certainly easier to imagine a different time and culture that could have been a little bit more relatable. And the idea being that there were other indications that would work out better from that perspective. So what about the Torah saying that she was born and they heard about it after the Akedah? So it could mean that they heard about it much later. Didn't mean necessarily that she was born then, but at that point they started hearing about the fact that she existed, and therefore that's significant. It's interesting, Bechlal, the fact that the Torah tells us about Rivka's birth right after the Akedah is perhaps meant itself to emphasize something, that maybe it says something about the Akedah, that the big nisayin of the Akedah, among other aspects of it, was the idea that Avram could still believe that this legacy that HaKadosh Baruch Hu promised him could still come true. That here he's being told that he's going to have a long line of descendants coming specifically from this son, from Yitzchak. And on the way up to the Akedah, it looks like Yitzchak's not going to survive. So how is that possible? So it takes a tremendous amount of emunah to be able to trust that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Havtacha is still going to come true when it doesn't look like there's any hope, doesn't look like there's any way things can turn around. At least that's how it would have appeared at the moment. So perhaps the fact that the Torah emphasizes right afterwards that Rivka's on the scene is to connect to that part of the story that, yes, this future is indeed on the horizon, and Yitzchak will indeed have the descendants that will lead to this tremendous nation. And perhaps that's also why we read it on Rosh Hashanah, when we read the story of the Akedah on Rosh Hashanah, on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. So the Kriyas HaTorah continues to that point. It doesn't just stop after the Akedah, but our laning continues up to mentioning the birth of Rivka. Perhaps that's a part of the point, that we have to understand that that all connects to what the Akedah is about. Okay, so then the next tefillah, next pasuk talks about tefillah. V'yatar Yitzchak l'Hashem l'nochach ishto ki akarohi. So apparently there was a difficulty in having a child, and they both prayed. They both davened opposite each other. Mefarshim talk about exactly what does it mean, opposite each other, nochach ishto. Maybe each one was davening on behalf of the other. Each one was concerned about the sorrow and the anguish of the other. So Yitzchak was praying on his wife's behalf, that she should have a child. And the Chazal had the idea that whoever davens on behalf of someone else, their answer is first. So here it's an interesting question. Two people who are both davening for literally the same thing, but the question is, each one is focusing on the needs of the other. Maybe there is a statement there. The idea of yatar, meaning tefillah, which nowadays is often used in a poetic sense, many rabbinic writings. So the idea that this conveys davening is an interesting usage. The Gemara Maseches Yevamos and Daf Samach Dalet, where there are many drashos about these psukim. So the Gemara suggests that it's a language being like a pitchfork. And a pitchfork turns over the hay, does activities like that. So too, tefillah has the capacity to turn over the gezerah, to make things flip. And the Gemara there also has a comment that the suggestion that Yitzchak, his tefillah was answered, and her tefillah was second to his, apparently. So that maybe reflects an idea the Gemara has over there, that ein adom bet tzadik ben tzadik, but tzadik ben rasha. That you have two tzadikim praying, but one is also the child of a tzadik, so that prayer has more koach to it. So it's interesting. You have to figure out what exactly that means, practically speaking. Does that mean to suggest that nowadays, if you have to choose a shliach tzibur, so you should prioritize a tzaddik ben tzaddik over a tzaddik of less illustrious lineage? So that was actually a machlokas. The Bach and the Marshal quoted on the side of the page of Aruch Chaim Siman Nun Gimel. So they indeed had that perspective. But the Taz disagrees. And the Taz says that, no, it's not about your yichus, it's about what you're putting into the tefillah. And that we say, Rachmana Libavoy, is a Gemara in Sanhedrin, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants the heart, a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants the dedication. And that's much more significant as far as how you're going to select the Shliach Tzibur. And the Torah quotes the Rush is actually a maila to somebody who is not so miuchas, who is not of such a distinguished lineage, to say, Shalom, Shalom, L'rachav, L'karav, that we want our tefillah to involve those who are close and those who are far. And the Tar Tamim over here quotes a proof from the Gemara Maseches Tainis and Daf Chof Hei, that the Gemara talks about how Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Elazar are both davened for the same thing, and Rabbi Akiva, his tefillah was answered, not because one was bigger than the other, but Bepneshez and Maver al Midosov. So what does Maver al Midosov mean? So someone, in different contexts it means different things. Sometimes it means not to bear a grudge. But here it sounds like it means somebody who overcomes his environment. That's a bigger schus, and therefore that's a better baal tefillah. That's somebody you should choose more. So that's how many suggest that al pidin, it's not this way. You're better off picking somebody who is a tzaddik, who doesn't necessarily come from such a distinguished lineage. So there are those who suggest that it all depends on how the parts add up, that if the tzaddik ben tzaddik is greater, okay, so then he should have priority. But if they're equal, then maybe the tzaddik ben rasha actually has a more zchus, has more that they are overcoming. There are also those who suggest that the idea of the tzaddik ben tzaddik is the assumption that the ancestors are also davening up in Shemayim on behalf of the children. So you have a tzaddik ben tzaddik, so there's a schus harabim, that it's not just the tzaddik davening, it's also the ancestors davening. But maybe in a tzibur context, you already have the whole tzibur, so then better to take the milas of the tzaddik ben Rasha. Maybe it's going to be a greater schus. The Kli Yakar, we'll mention again, a couple of kelim yikarim today, that the Kli Yakar suggests in that sense, back to this idea of Avram Holidus Yitzchok, the idea that the ancestors are a part of the schus. So here we have Yitzchok ben Avram. So Avram, if it's Tzadik ben Tzadik, Avram was apparently a part of the factor here. Why the tefillah was successful. So this is Avram Holidus Yitzchok. The language Holid is an interesting language. You know, Parshas Bereishis, when it lists all the lineages, it's all so-and-so, Yoladah, so-and-so, Yoladah, so-and-so. So what is Holid? So Holid, it sounds like grammatically, it means it made someone else have a child. So Avram Holid is Yitzchak, the Chus of Avram, was a contributory factor in why Yitzchak was able to be successful in his tefillah. So, okay, so Vatai Rivka, so she becomes pregnant, and then right away things get a little challenging. Vayisrotzitzu habonim bekirba. And the children, told, are fighting in her stomach, in her belly. Vatomerim kein lama zanochi v'telech lidros hashasam. So she says, if this is the case, so lama zanochi, what does that mean, lama zanochi? Why should I exist? And what does it mean? So Rashi suggests it means that be careful what you wish for. So here I'm davening for a child, for a pregnancy, and now I see it's so difficult. Why do I ask for this? And the Mefarshim say, if why was everyone davening on my behalf if this is what it's like? The Ibn Ezra and others suggest that it means that she asked other women who have had children. She said, what is pregnancy like? And they said, you know, it's got its ups and downs, but it didn't sound like it was as bad as what she was going through. So she realized there's something up, there's something unusual here. And that's what made her ask. So, Vatelech Lidrosh Es Hashem. So she went to investigate with God. So what does that mean, to investigate with God? So the Ramban says it means tefillah. It means that she davened to God to get some kind of insight into what's going on. And others understand it differently. So if you look at Rashi, understands that she went to consult Shem. She went to Shem, the son of Noach, and one could suggest, if one wants to, that this is the earliest mucker we have for Das Torah. And somebody is trying to figure out what's going on in their lives, so they go to the Talmud Chacham. They say, try to help me understand what's going on. Try to help me have some sense of perspective. So, is that what was going on? It's a good question. The Netziv understands this idea of Rashi and the Rashbam also, who has this notion that she was talking to Shem, that she was going to a Navi. Apparently had an idea that Shem was a Navi. I don't know if that's an idea we find in other sources. We usually relate to Shem as Talmud Chacham. You would say that maybe that's better. We say Chacham Odif Minavi. But the Netziv understands here that she was going to speak to the Navi. And because the Ramban says about tefillah, so why did she have to go anywhere for tefillah? We already know that she was effective in tefillah in her own household. What does it mean to go somewhere? So he suggests that she was looking for nevuah, but nevuah also, you'd think she has in her own family. She could go to Avram for nevuah. So he explains there that there's different kinds of nevuah, different kinds of people who God speaks to. There are people who have a mission, and the Navi, God speaks to them as a Navi and says, here's what you should tell people, here's what you should do. And there are those who are Nevi'im in the sense that they know things. They know about what's going on in the world, and they are available to be consulted for people's questions. So in that sense, it really does kind of go back to the whole idea of kind of a Das Torah perspective here, one way or another, where they're coming at it as a Nevuah, or you're coming at it as a Chacham. So the Netziv is focusing it on it as a Nevuah, but one could have understood it also as just somebody who's very insightful and very learned, and therefore maybe could give an Eitzah about how to understand things spiritually. But one way or another, the next Pasuk tells us that she gets an answer from God. It says, V'yomer Hashem la. So God is the one who answers. So what does that mean, that God is the one who answers? It means that was through some kind of a nevuah or a shlichus or an interpretation but she gets a response from God, the pasuk indicates, Shnei goyim bevitneich, that there are two nations that are in you, and Shnei le'umim imayachi paredu lo'om melom yamatz v'rav yavod seir. So there's going to be a big destiny here. There's going to be these two nations that are going to emerge from the two children that you are carrying, and they're going to be very substantial. And the older one is going to end up serving the younger one. So already some major foreshadowing here. So the next pasuk continues, v'yim lu'u yamel ol'edes v'nei somim b'vitna. So there the day comes when her due date approaches. She's already ready now to give birth. And wow, here are twins. It's interesting. It's my grandfather in his commentary on the Torah Tamimah just points out that it's a little hard to understand this pasuk, because why would you need to be surprised here that there are twins? So already we've had now two indications that she knows that there are twins. First, there Haban and Bekirba. We saw that she saw that two were fighting inside of her, and then she's told that they're going to be two separate nations, and they're going to come from these two children. So it's not clear what the pasuk is conveying by saying, wow, surprise, here are twins. But okay, so here are the twins. V'yetze harishon admoni kulo kadera seyar v'yikru shmo Esav. So the first one is born, and he is very hairy, and he is red, and he is called Esav. V'achrechein yotza achiv yado ochezes ba'kev Esav v'yikru shmo Yaakov v'yitzchak ben shishim shana b'ledes osam. So here the second one comes out, and he is holding on to the heel, and he's called Yaakov. So Leah is really full of foreshadowing. Every pasuk is like if it's trying to give you a preview of what's coming soon. So now we're told that Yitzchak is 60 years, and again, this parallels the idea that's emphasizing how long of a process is. Why is he married at 40 and he has his twin children at the age of 60? Vayigdulu hanarim v'yesav ish yodei etzayid ish soda v'yakov ish tam yoshev oholim. So the boys grow up. So apparently the boys become bar mitzvah, and we see they have different natures, that Esav was somebody who was into hunting. He was a man of the field. V'Yaakov ishtam yoshev ohalim. And that Yaakov was a man of simplicity, but we mean that in a very positive sense. He was somebody who was complete, who was whole, and he would sit in the tents. He was the Talmud Chacham. And of course, that's how Rabbeinu Tam got his name, his nickname, essentially, because Rabbeinu Tam, his name was Yaakov, but he was Talmud Chacham. He sat in the tents, so he was referred to as Rabbeinu Tam, but his name was really Yaakov. Personal note, I've told my son that his name is in the Torah, in Parshas Toldos. So you might say that, okay, Yaakov's name is over the Tanakh, so why is that surprising? This pasuk specifically, because it says, Ish HaSada V'Yaakov. So if you translate that, that means Feldman Kami Yaakov. So Ish HaSada is a field man. So that's where the name comes from. So in any event, so these boys, they become bar mitzvah. So these boys become bar mitzvah, and there's a medrash over here that says that you have to deal with the children until they are bar mitzvah, until they're 13, in the case of boys, and then you say Baruch Shepetrani Me'on Shol Silzah. So there is this idea of making a bracha at the time of the bar mitzvah, that you declare gratitude for being released from the onesh. And the Ramah Narachayim in Reish Chofei quotes this idea that a bar mitzvah boy's father says this without Shema Malchus. There's some discussion about this, of exactly whether the bracha is appropriate to make or not. The idea of making a bracha that's not found specifically in Chazal as an instruction is why they say to make it without Shema Malchus. There's a whole back and forth about this bracha. Is it a real bracha or not? But also, what is the idea of being exempted, me'on shel shelzeh, you don't have any more responsibility for chinuch at that point? Is that what we're saying? Presumably it's not true. Presumably the obligation of chinuch in some ways really kicks in, especially nowadays. You have teenagers, so that's when the ikar chinuch really kicks in. But the Magen Avraham understands that before bar mitzvah, so before bar bas mitzvah, the parent has the responsibility for all the averos of the child and bears liability. And then once the child is an adult, so he's saved from that liability, so he declares a thank you for that. They say in the name of the Baal Shem Tov, a very nice pshat on this idea, that when you have younger children, so they're not really able to appreciate the inherent value of things. So sometimes chinuch has to take place through the path of basically reward and punishment, through incentive and disincentive, through the carrot and the stick, and that's all very external. It's sometimes necessary, and we say mitoch shelo lishma ba lishma, but our real hope is that eventually the child will get older and will be able to appreciate things for their actual worth, and will recognize they should do good things because they're good, and they should avoid the bad things because they're bad. So you transition into a different stage of education, and maybe al pi derech hadrush, that's what we're saying, that until now we're focused on the onesh. But beyond that, I can now not focus on the onesh, but focus on really understanding what things are about. And that's the declaration. That's what we're getting at. There is a often quoted comment of Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch over here, which there's a lot to say about. Rav Hirsch is actually very critical of Yitzchak in this context. We always have a very delicate approach to knowing when to take that angle. But he suggests that the reason that they ended off in such divergent and conflicting paths is because Yitzchak educated them both in the same way. And because they were so different, they really shouldn't have been educated in the same way. We say, Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko, that we should have an appreciation for the unique nature of each child and educate them accordingly. And that there's a criticism that's implied here that once they grew up, it wasn't fully appreciated just how different they were. And now that they became adults, so it ends up playing out. And that's there's a lot to talk about this. Our friend of Simon Shlit, an essay from Rebbe Baruch, if I recall correctly, has an essay about this. So there's a lot to consider about that comment. The next pasuk says, "Ve'ahav Yitzchak es Esav ki tzayid b'fiv, v'rivko heves es Yaakov." So this is a very difficult pasuk to relate to also. Here it seems to us that it's so clear that Yaakov is the hero here and Esav isn't, and that Rivka is on the right track in understanding which one is the spiritual son. And Yitzchak doesn't get it. So Yitzchak, he is enamored of Esav, kisayit b'fiv. It almost sounds ki'ilu, as if it's saying that he was able to bribe him, that he was able to win him over with his hunting and with his good food. So presumably you have to assume there's more to it. The Rashiv of Karen B'Avna had a whole mahalach here, and the Mashgiach of Karen B'Avna, Rav Rivlin, discusses it also in his farm. We can find it discussed in both places, that it's not that Yitzchak liked Esav and Rivka liked Rivka liked Yaakov, and that was the whole story. It's that what Yaakov thought, or what Yitzchak thought, was that Yaakov was purely spiritual, and he thought that Esav was more of a mixture of both, was one who had a spiritual mentality, and was also able to merge that with a engagement with the physical world. And therefore he thought that the brachos that would be given, the brachos would really be about how to make this world into a successful spiritual physical blend, and that therefore it was Esav who had more of a proclivity in that direction, and that's why Esav was more appropriate for these brachos. It's an interesting question. I wonder also, maybe a little bit up derech hadrush, whether it's possible to say that the Ahav doesn't necessarily have to refer to a natural reaction that, oh, he's so impressed, he loves him. But we understand that a parent loving a child is also something that they decide to do, something that they recognize is their role, to be there as a loving parent for the child, not because, oh, they're so impressed, they love the child, but because as the parent, they have to actively love the child. And the more that Esav was somewhat of a complicated individual. So Yitzchak's response to that was, okay, I have to love him more, I have to pay him more attention, I have to try to figure out how to cultivate that, which is probably at odds with the Hirsch's interpretation, maybe a little bit more consistent with the Rosh Yeshiva's interpretation, but maybe that's what the Pasuk is getting at. It's saying Kizayit Befiv, that he didn't have a straight kind of spiritual nature as Yaakov did. So maybe it's like thinking, okay, Yaakov, I can leave him on his own, he'll turn out to be the Gadol Ador, he doesn't really need me to be very involved. But Esav had a more complicated relationship to the world, so I have to love him more, I have to be more involved in how to raise him. Okay, so there's a lot more to say here, just to figure out how to organize it. So there are a couple more things happening before this Aliyah ends. So one thing to focus on here is the major excitement of the selling of the Bechorah. So just to look at the Pesukim first. So, Vayazer Yaakov Nozid, Vayavo Esav Ben Asadav Hu Ayev. So Yaakov is making some food, is making a stew, and Esav comes in, and he's exhausted. So why was Yaakov cooking? So Chazal tell us that now Avram has passed away. And so Yitzchak is sitting Shiva, Yitzchak is in Avelos, so Yaakov is making a Suda for him. And Esav shows up. Vayomer Esav el Yaakov, Haliteni na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh, ki ayef anochi, alkein kro shmo Edom. So Esav says to Yaakov, he says that I'm starving, I'm exhausted, so give me from that red stuff that you are making. And because of this, he was called Edom. Interesting question how this plays out. He was called Edom because of this. Some of the Farshim say that they made fun of him for having this attitude and it became a nickname for him. Others have different interpretations. But the idea of Hadom Hadom Hazeh, which already conveys a certain lack of care about what you're really involved with. You're just saying that red stuff, give that to me. I heard once in somebody's name. You know, the whole discussion in general, drinking from soda cans. You know, do you drink directly from the can? Does it need to have tefillah? Do you need to be told of the can before you drink it or not? So I heard somebody once suggest, I forgot whose name this was in, that thought to just stomp from a Midos perspective, that if you don't pour the drink out first, then it's like Esav, Doma, Doma, Zah, just whatever that is, just give it to me. So I don't necessarily have to interpret it that way. But in any event, so he asks for this food. So Yaakov says, okay, here's the deal. Sell me your Bechorah. So Esav says, well, I'm going to die anyway, so what do I care about this Bechorah? So Yomer Yaakov, Hishava li kayom, Vayishava lo, Vayimkor es Bechorah li Yaakov. So Yaakov says, swear to me, that's the deal. And he swore to him, and he sells his Bechorah to Yaakov. Yaakov nosen le'esav lechem unizir adoshim v'yochal v'yesht v'yakom v'yelech v'yivez esav esav Bechorah. Okay, so Yaakov gives him the food, and he eats it, and he drinks, he gets up, and he goes. And Esav is disdainful of the Bechorah. So there's a lot to figure out here about this crucial episode of the selling of the birthright. So one can explore it both from a ethical perspective and also from a technical legal perspective. So one question we need to figure out, we know that Esav ends up significantly upset about this later on, so how should we feel about this? Do we feel that Yaakov took advantage of Esav here? What exactly was going on? So Esav comes in desperate, comes in thinking he's going to die. So should we assume that Yaakov exploited that desperation and ended up taking advantage of it and getting this birthright for nothing, getting this birthright for a song, for a bowl of soup? So there's a very fascinating article about this by Murray Virabi, Rabbi Aaron Levine, Zichron Lebracha, who wrote an article about this for the first volume of Mitoch Ohel on the Parsha. So there he wrote for Parshas Toldos, he wrote what I always thought was one of the best Torah Mada representations in that volume. A really fascinating article where he considers this whole episode from the perspective of an economist. Rabbi Levine was a giant in learning and in economics. So he considers this question of, was this a fair price or not? So we know that in halacha we have a concept of onah, that it's not permissible to sell something at too high a price or to buy something at too low of a price and essentially to mislead the other party, to overcharge or to underpay. It's what we call onah. It's hard to translate it directly into English. It's often translated as price fraud. That's normally prohibited. So is that what happened here? Did Yaakov underpay for this bechora? So he goes through it in a very fascinating way, the whole concept of onah and how we relate here. And part of the problem is, so you have to define a price. You have to be able to figure out what exactly is the appropriate market price for this item. So here you don't really have a market price because this is what he called a bilateral monopoly. When you have a monopoly, we usually mean that you have one seller and everyone has no choice but to buy from that one seller, so the monopolist has control. But here you have a bilateral monopoly because you only have one person in the world who could sell this, and you only have one person in the world who's interested in buying this. So how exactly do you figure out a market price in that case if you only have one buyer in the world and one seller in the world? So he discusses, he compares this to a view of Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra, which is quoted in the Braisa in Bav Metzia. And there, it's not clear how he paskin, it's a machlokas, but Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra holds that when you're on the battlefield and somebody wants to buy on the battlefield, he wants to buy a sword or he wants to buy a horse that he can continue to fight and to survive. So there, Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra says there's no onah. That essentially the market price is irrelevant because we don't look at how the market would charge for a sword. We look at the fact that right now this guy only has one place he can get the sword from, the guy next to him, and the guy who is interested in selling the sword is not going to go put it on eBay and wait a few weeks and see who's going to buy it. He's going to only have it to this sell it to this guy. So the market changes. We don't necessarily look at some abstract market price. We look specifically at the fact that these are the only two people in the market right now. And therefore, that's how we determine the price. So from that perspective, he analyzes the economics of the situation, and he comes to the conclusion that this was not any kind of a exploitation or any kind of a deception, that that's what the price is under those circumstances. And therefore, it was a legitimate price to charge. But then you might still say, as he goes through, but okay, but now waiting until that moment when Esav was so exhausted and starving and saying, okay, now is when I'm going to make the deal. Is that something that was l'chadchila, an inappropriate way to do it? Was that putting him in a situation where he's going to exploit his desperation? So Rabbi Levine discusses there that no, he says that's not the case. He says one way to look at it, which he ultimately dismisses, is that the greater risk was that Yaakov was going to be exploited by Esav, that Esav didn't really care about the Bechorah. And it's an interesting discussion. Mefarshim, what does it mean when he says here, Ani Anochi Holech Lamos, he says, I'm going to die, so does it mean that I'm desperate right now, I'm going to die without the soup, so I just have to sell the Bechorah? Well, Mefarshim understand it in other ways, that he didn't really believe in a future. In general, he didn't believe in the next world. He didn't believe in the spiritual value. He didn't believe that the avoda was worth it if it carries with it risks. So therefore, he said, this whole thing is worthless to me. So I don't really put much stock in it. So if he holds that it's worthless, but he knows that Yaakov is a spiritual person, and Yaakov is going to hold that it is worthwhile, so there is the possibility of exploiting Yaakov. So maybe Yaakov had to wait until things were essentially even So there was some kind of a distracting factor so that he would be able to get it at a fair price. He wasn't getting it at an unfair price. Esav didn't value it much in the first place, but he was worried about Esav exploiting him. So he waited until there was this distracting element. But then Rabbi Levine suggests that that's also not in keeping with Yaakov's tmimus, so he didn't think that that was that either. But he says that it was his appreciation that only really kicked in at that moment that Esav wasn't worthy. And that the Gemara tells us in Baba Basra that on that day Esav did a whole list of terrible averos, but together with them was his expression of heresy, essentially, where he says, "What's the Ayanayanokhi Olech Lamos? I don't believe in anything in the future. So what do I need this for?" So it was at that moment that Yaakov really appreciated that he didn't have the appreciation for the Bechorah that would allow him to keep it, and that's when he decided, okay, I'll make my offer instead. And he goes through it over there in the article, a very kedai reading. The book is very kedai to have, if I may say so. And this article is a very fascinating article. And Chazal tell us that Yaakov was Tom, and the Pasuk also says Larogal Alashono, that he was somebody who didn't speak Lashon Hara. So even though when the boys became Bar Mitzvah, so people started to hear about the different nature of each one and about the unfortunate behaviors of Esav, but Yaakov wasn't Makabel. So it was only now, 2 years later, when he hears it directly from how Esav is expressing himself. So then he realized, okay, now I see it myself, that Esav is not somebody who is roi for the Bechora, and therefore he says, okay, I'm going to have to make my move, and I'm going to take this chance to buy it from him. But still, there's a lot of technical legal questions, because how exactly does this work? So you know, nowadays there's a whole genre of Sfarim that discuss halachic issues in the Parsha. Very prominent among them, Rav Asher Weiss's Sefer Merchas Asher, which was just released in a expanded edition. The volume on Bereishis is available. So one of the topics that these forum talk about most in this parsha is the technicalities of how do you sell a birthright? You know, what exactly does that mean to sell a birthright? Shouldn't we say? And this is something that the Mefarshim and Chumash already spoke about, the Rechayim and the Ramban and the Barbanel, the Malbim all address the question of what are you selling, the future inheritance? So that's a Davar Shalob Olam. It's something that right now is not in front of you. And normally you sell that, you can't sell a Davar Shalob Olam. So the Panim Yafos was one of the Rebbeim of the Chassam Sofer. Panim Yafos says over here that the emphasis on Mechra Kayom, sell it to me today, is talking about addressing that issue, is saying there's something I'm selling right now, it's not just a future inheritance. So it's a reference to the Avoda, that's what he's selling, and therefore the Yerusha came along with that. But in earlier sources we see opposite inclinations, so the Torah quotes from the Rush, essentially that it's not about anything other than the Yerusha, because the Yerusha is physical, and that's where you could have Tfisas Kenyan. So how exactly do we deal with the Lo Bala Olam part? So that's where he suggests that that's what the Shvuah is here for. The Shvuah is here to address the Lo Bala Olam component. Now, the Rivash and his Shuvas, he rejects that because he says that, first of all, this was Kodem Matan Torah, so we don't have the exact same halacha, so you can't derive from here. He's talking about lamaisa. Should we say if somebody wants to sell something today, that's lo bala olam, if you were to use a shvua, would that help? So the Rivash says it can't derive anything from here, because Kodem Matan Torah, that was just a chizuk. He doesn't accept that interpretation, that was a kinyan on the future Yerusha itself. So how do you address this? So the later Svarim that talk about this, so they note that it is a machlokes among the earlier Svarim as to why is it that there is a problem with the Davar Shalob Olam? Why is it that that impacts on the Kinyan? So some, like Rabbeinu Tam and the Sefer Yasher, and the Mukhi Yosef and Baba Basra, and a few others, the Rechaim over here, and the Mabit, and the Prisha, they understand that it's an issue of Smichas Das. that Kenyan requires seriousness, as we spoke about last week. And if you don't have something in front of you that's relevant right now, so then it's hard to say there's a real smichas gas. While the Tashbetz, it's also quoted in the Torah, Tashbetz says differently, that it's an issue that there is just no reality to it. There's no metzias. So how can you transfer something that has no metzias? The Chazon Ish understood like that, that it's a problem of begidrei hakinyan, that if you don't have something that you can control, so then how can you transfer something you can't control? That's what transferring property means. The Ketzos addressed this. The Ketzos wrote that for the purposes of a siluk, if you want to just remove yourself from a situation, you want to walk away from something, so that you can do before it kicks in. But then you still have to address the problem of how does it transfer over to Yaakov. So maybe Esav can walk away from the Bechorah, but it doesn't address how Yaakov ends up taking it over. Now, the Sforno understands that the soup here was used as a kinyan chalipin. And then maybe that helps for Davar Shlomo Le'olam. Rav Asher Weiss has a whole essay about that, the Menachos Asher, how maybe when you have chalipin, that is something that is able to be effective. This discussion was the food, the chalipin. Normally we say that you can't use food for chalipin, so maybe it was the pot that was used for the kinyan chalipin. There's a lot of technicalities to figure out. So if you plan on buying any birthrights or selling any birthrights, just be aware that it's not a pashut thing to pull off. So make sure to go through all the relevant inyanim and the halachas beforehand, because there's a lot that has to be figured out. But this idea of Aivez Esav as HaBechorah, the fact that we see that even after he was satisfied, even after he ate and he got what he wanted, so it sounds like he still was disdainful of the Bechorah. It's not that, okay, now that I'm not desperate anymore, and now I'm able to reorient my perspective, but he's still disdainful. Of course, you could understand this a few ways, that the very act of eating this, buying this in exchange for the Bechorah was itself a demeaning of the Bechorah. But it sounds like it means that his whole continued attitude was a disgrace of the Bechorah. And it's interesting to get technical here. There's a discussion about this in the Tshuvas of the Chalkas Asad. The Chalkas Asad was written by Blazer Deutsch, was a Hungarian Dayan, who was a contemporary of the Chassam Sofer. So he understands that there's a relevance here, because the whole idea of covet to an older brother, of an older sibling getting covet. So why is there a din of kavod for an older brother? So it's interesting. It's a machlokas rishonim that's more well known. But the Rambam understands that bechorah is about the birthright, the fact that the older, in his case specifically, the oldest brother has a special status of bechorah, is going to take over the father's position as yorish gedulas aviv. While the Ramban understands it differently. The Ramban understands that kavod that goes to an older sibling is because of the umdana, the expectation that that's what parents want, that kibud av v'em means you have to do things that make the parents happy. And most parents want that the younger siblings should respect the older siblings. So they point out in Nafka Mina, the Rosh Hashanah and others talk about that, what if it's a sibling from only one parent? Let's say you have a half-sibling. So let's say the sibling is not from the father. So according to the Rambam, but it's about Yerushas HaBechor, it should only be a older brother from the father. But according to the Ramban, that it's about this parental desire for a hierarchy among the siblings, so then any older sibling should be eligible for kavod. But there's an unusual position that Yevgenis and Eibshitz has, which doesn't seem to correlate to either, that he writes in his commentary to Chumash and Parshas Vayigash, that one is only chayv and kavod to a sibling from the same mother. Doesn't seem to fit either opinion. According to Ramban, it should be either parent, and according to the Rambam, it should be the father. So why only from the same mother? So it's Rav Yonasan Aipshus L'shitoso, because in his Yaros Devash, in his Drashos, he explains a whole new perspective on the idea of kavod for an older sibling. That the idea is, it's from the Din Hakara Satov, that Hakara Satov, we don't just show gratitude because people choose to help us and we're grateful for their willingness. We show recognition that we have something that we otherwise maybe wouldn't have had. So that's why we know that Moshe Rabbeinu had a karas hatov for the Nile River. He wasn't the one to hit the Nile River. And we find other indications that we have a karas hatov even for inanimate objects. Because it's not just about Derech Eretz, it's about recognizing that our life is different because of whatever it was that came before us. So Rav Eichfried says that a karas hatov is to the older sibling, because when the older sibling was born, we're grateful that the mother was able to remain intact afterwards and able to have more children, because otherwise the younger siblings wouldn't exist. So our whole appreciation for being alive, we have some degree of appreciation also for an older sibling who made it possible for us to stay alive. So the Chalkas HaSada suggests, based on that, Ve'iva Zesuv Sabachar, who thinks life doesn't mean anything, doesn't think there's anything important, so then he's not interested in the covet of an older sibling. It's not something that's relevant, but this is particularly relevant to us this week, because we know that tomorrow we're not going to have shir, because we don't have on the schedule because of Thanksgiving. So Thanksgiving is an opportunity to really reflect on the fact that we're very grateful to have many opportunities that we otherwise might not have. We're grateful to live in a country that gives us opportunities that people all over the world and all throughout history have not had, and to have kindness and to have benefits and to have freedoms and liberties that are not a given at all, and that we do what we can to hold on to those and to make sure they're properly utilized. And that requires having an appreciation, having a hakaras hatov for that, and through that sense of hakaras hatov, to have that appreciation for everything else as well. So all of this is very much a focus as we look towards Thanksgiving, as we look towards having a day to reflect on the brachos that we have in our lives, and how it's not a given that they're going to be there, and how that's going to impact everything else that we do. In that sense of appreciation, maybe we'll just quickly mention that the last pasuk is very significant also, the last pasuk of this aliyah, which tells us that there is this great bracha that's given to Avram and his descendants. So the aliyah ends, Ekev asher shama Avram bekoli v'yishmar mishmarati mitzvosa chukosa v'sarosa. That this is because Avram listened to God and he follows all the rules. He follows the Dinam Daraisa, he follows the Dinam Darabana, and he follows all of the policies. So the Gemara Maseches Yuma, Daf Chav Ches Amud Beis, says over here that this is teaching us that Avram followed the whole Torah even before it was given, even down to the Dinam Darabana, and even the Eir of Tashilin, the Gemara says. He observed before it was given. And there's a lot to figure out about this. Does this mean Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov or others in between? Is it referred to the Avos? Referred to other biblical figures before the Torah was given? So there's a lot written about that. And there's a lot written also about what exactly does that mean. Does that mean every din, even the ones that are specifically rooted in historical events, like the Zechiras HaMalek? How exactly do we understand that? Does it refer to Aseis and Los Aseis? The Mar Alpha, it only refers to Aseis. There's a lot that is discussed about this and its implications. But what it seems to convey, and this is how some of the Rishonim, the Rashbaz, the Shuvar explains it this way, that Avram understood the values of the Torah, and therefore, even before the mitzvahs were given, he was able to figure out what they all would be, and he acted on that understanding, even though it wasn't actually a commandment. And we could probably suggest also that that's what it means, bikoli, not likoli, that he didn't listen to my instructions, but he listened to the voice itself. He listened to the content of what God was conveying to him in their interactions, and he was able to figure out what all the mitzvahs were. So there are a lot of questions that are asked on the assumption that the Avos kept the whole Torah. So one of the more well-known questions is, how does Yaakov eventually end up marrying two sisters? There's a prohibition against marrying two sisters, so how could Yaakov do that? And the Ramban understands that they only observed the mitzvahs in Eretz Yisrael, not outside of Eretz Yisrael. But I was thinking you could also maybe say that we have a rule of Ein Dorshin Taima D'Kra, that we're not allowed to try to assume we know what mitzvos mean and to apply the halacha based on our understanding. But that's because we have a Torah, we have commandments, so we're not allowed to say that this is what we think they mean and this is how we'll apply them. But presumably the Avos, they didn't have any issue of Ein Dorish and time of the Krah because they didn't have a Krah. They were not commanded in the Torah. They figured out what the mitzvos were supposed to be. So if that's how they figured it out, so presumably they do have the right to work based on their understanding. Maybe Yaakov thought that the idea that you're not supposed to marry two sisters is because they're more likely to fight with each other. That's going, just like we say, Atzara, that's going to create greater tension to have two sisters married to the same man, and therefore the Torah prohibits it. But he saw the way Rachel and Leah look out for each other, as we'll read about eventually. So he was a Dorish Taima of the non-Kra, that this is not going to be a concern to be married to both sisters, and perhaps that's why he was Morahet to himself, that's why he decided that this was something he was permitted to do. But in any event, one way or another, this goes to the whole theme of Hakaras HaTov as well, just to be able to really recognize and to appreciate what it is the meaning behind things, and like the Besht had said about Baruch Shepetrani, that to get to the point where we're not necessarily focused exclusively on the reward and the punishment, but on the meaning behind it, and to be able to fully acknowledge and to appreciate what those mean, and to aspire to a life that is connected to that more than needing the carrot or the stick in order to keep us in line. So we will stop here. Wish everyone a meaningful and gratitude-filled Thanksgiving.